Hi.
And welcome back
to Behind the Crime.
I'm Rebecca Wood.
And I'm Ella Calora.
And we are doing a special episode. It's not coming out on the day that we normally put episodes out, but it's Halloween.
Yeah, we're doing a little Halloween episode. It's going to be different than our usual episodes.
Yeah, very different.
We're going to do a list of 13 different crimes that happened on Halloween over a big span of years. We have some more recent ones, and we have a bunch of older ones.
Yeah. I'd say we have a lot of, like, 80s and 90s cases.
Yeah.
And we don't want this to come across like we're doing this because, like, we're like, it's Halloween, it's fun, because that's not the point of us having this podcast. Mm-hmm. We're genuinely trying to bring attention to these cases because, especially when things happen on a holiday, they tend to get forgotten and not talked about as much because people are too focused on the good parts, which we also don't want this to be like a deterrent to be like, you can't have fun on Halloween because bad things happen. But it's also a reminder that, yeah, Halloween's a fun day, just like any other holiday, like Christmas, but people do still get murdered, kidnapped, whatever else we're talking about.
Yeah.
So it's important to, like, not let your guard down.
Yeah. So let's get into it.
All right. I'm going to go first, and I'm talking about the case of William V. Schein, who was a prominent dentist in Central California in, like, the 50s. I mean, probably, like, the 40s, too, but he apparently was very prominent, like, a well-known dentist, I guess. He got a lot of business. On Halloween night in 1959, Schein gave out candy, which I have written in quotes because, plot twist, it was not candy, as you'll hear about in a minute. So he gave out 450 pieces of this quote-unquote candy.
450?
Mm-hmm. And, like, there's no known amount of trick-or-treaters, like, little kids that... there's no measurement of how many kids got this, but there's measurement of, like, what happened to them. So, unfortunately, the candy he gave out was actually candy-coated laxatives, like, meant for adults, not for children, you know what I mean? Because it's one... like, an adult can take two Advils, but a little kid can only take one. So it's a similar thing of, like, these are not meant for children to consume for so many reasons. So... most of the kids, luckily, didn't eat them. Like, their parents were like, what is this? Because I'm also pretty sure it was just, like, loose. Like, he just, like, sprinkled it in, like, no wrapper.
Oh.
Because, I mean, what was he, like, where else was he going to put it?
Yeah.
So, luckily, a lot of the kids that he gave them to didn't eat them. But 30 kids did eat laxatives and got violently ill for hours. Luckily, nobody was permanently injured or killed.
That's good.
But they were sick for hours. Like, it was awful. And, like, they were, like, throwing up really badly, too. Because, again, medicine affects children differently than it does for adults. So the families actually traced the laxatives back to Schein, like, before they even brought this to the police. They figured out, I guess, with other families and other people who didn't even eat the candy but saw it, they figured out which house it came from. And a municipal judge issued two warrants for his arrest. The warrants that they issued were outrage of public decency and unlawful dispensing of drugs. So that's what he was arrested for a few days later.
Child endangerment.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. When I was reading, I was like, hello? Dr. Leonard Ortega ran lab tests on the pills that were distributed and said that a child could easily have died from dehydration if they had enough of the laxatives. They found as much, like, up to 30 laxatives in one kid's bag.
Oh, my God.
And even one, taking one of them was enough for the kids to get so sick.
Yeah.
So if someone did get 30, and that's just of what they know of, who knows if someone else had 40, you know? So... Schein was given a four-month suspended jail sentence, 2 years probation, and a $525 fine. And the dental board, because keep in mind, he's a dentist who works with children as well.
Yeah.
The dental board found him guilty of unbecoming conduct and placed him on probation for 2 years, meaning for 2 years he wasn't allowed to practice. Later, he was charged with insurance fraud and spent 2 months in a county jail. So... he spent more time in jail for insurance fraud than for literally almost, like, potentially killing at least 30 children.
Like, yeah.
Like we said, these are a lot shorter cases. We're not going super, super in depth, but if there is something that you'd want to hear more about, you should tell us.
Yeah.
And we can do that in a future episode.
We'll also post the links for mm-hmm. all of them on our stories. So if you want to read more in depth too, you can look at that. Or you can just look up these people's names.
Yeah, there's a lot of articles for most of these.
Yeah. Okay, so my first case is Ronald O'Brien, also known as the Candyman and also known as the man who killed Halloween. He was convicted of killing his 8-year-old son, Timothy, on Halloween night in 1974. And this happened in Pasadena, Texas. So Ronald had laced a pixie stick that Timothy had gotten trick-or-treating with potassium cyanide, and he poisoned his son to collect life insurance money that he had just taken out, like, a life insurance policy on his son a few months mm-hmm. prior. And this was because at the time Ronald was not financially doing well, so he was $100,000 in debt. So I guess that's how much his son's life was worth to him, which is like really sad.
Yeah. Because that's not realistically, that's not that much when you're considering your child's life.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like it was a million.
Yeah. So
even then it wouldn't be okay. Like, that's not what I'm saying.
He also gave the pixie sticks, the poison pixie sticks, to his daughter and 3 other children in the neighborhood.
Oh,
and
I didn't know that part.
This was in an attempt to cover up his crime. And thankfully, none of the other kids ate it. Only Timothy did. So when they were out trick-or-treating, they went to this one house. This was what he also used as, like, his cover-up. So they went to this one house and no one answered the door. The kids were, they ran ahead because they were, you know, they wanted candy. And Ronald stayed behind, and then he came up to the kids a few minutes later with these pixie sticks and told the kids that the owner of the house that they were just at, who didn't answer the door, did answer the door and gave him a pixie stick for each kid. So then later that night, they got home. And Timothy wanted to eat candy before going to bed, and Ronald said yes. And this part makes me really upset. Timothy had a hard time, he was having a hard time getting the candy out, and Ronald actually helped Timothy get the candy out, and then Timothy said that it was bitter and he didn't like it, and Ronald gave him Kool-Aid to wash it down so Timothy would eat all of it. And then just like an hour later, Timothy started getting really sick, and he was rushed to the hospital but died on the way there.
Was he married, the father? Where was the mother during all this? You know what I mean?
I didn't see anything. I think he was a single dad. I'm not sure. Ronald was convicted of capital murder in June of 1975 and sentenced to death. He was executed by lethal injection in March of 1984. I just think it's crazy that he helped Timothy get it out of the pixie stick. Also, and not at any point he stopped.
Only took out a life insurance policy on Timothy, not his daughter, too? Like, he didn't think that was sus?
No, apparently he did not.
Bro, the fact that he, like, thought, okay, I can kill Timothy or I can kill my daughter. I just don't know the daughter's name. And he picked one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that makes it worse to me.
And gave it to 3 other neighborhood children.
Yeah, he literally could have killed
5 kids.
5 children.
Yeah.
Just because he was in debt.
Yeah.
So file for bankruptcy. Like,
but, like, giving it to the other kids was supposedly to cover up his tracks.
Yeah, but how did... But if they ate them, then he would have killed 5 kids.
I guess
because
if... Do
you think that the daughter, like, wanted to eat it, but he didn't let her?
I don't know. I think... He would have, I think his goal was to have one or both of his children eat it. Mm-hmm. And then I think he was hoping that the other kids would eat it. So then it wouldn't seem like he was trying to kill his kid for the money.
Yeah.
Because then why would he kill the other children?
Yeah. Or at least
I think that's what
they ate it and they're like, oh, this tastes weird. And then, you know, something got found out, but
yeah,
I can't.
But yeah, so when they were investigating it, he was blaming the neighbor who didn't answer the door. That neighbor was actually, like, he worked in, like, the air control, whatever it's called for.
Yeah, like the tower.
Yeah. And he was at work, and 200 people verified that this man was at work. So then they knew that Ronald was lying. I mean,
at least his cover-up didn't work.
Yeah.
Okay. So the next case that I'm going to talk about is the case of Cindy Song, who disappeared. Cindy Song grew up in South Korea until 1995 when she moved to Virginia to live with her aunt and uncle. She did this when she was 15. She was born in 1980. When she was 15, she moved to Virginia with her aunt and uncle and lived with them from then on. And at this point, it's 2001, and she is an art major at Penn State, holding down two jobs and having really good grades. And she was described as a very responsible person, but she still was enjoying her freedom a lot of being at college, which is normal, you know, makes sense. But it was Halloween 2001, and her two friends, Stacy Polk and Lisa Kim, they went out to a Halloween party, wherever their favorite. Mm-hmm. It was like a place they had gone to before, so it wasn't new. According to her friend Lisa, Cindy was dressed up as a rabbit. And she said it was just, like, a very, like, cutesy costume.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, another way that she was described as very cutesy. So they left the party around 2 a.m. and went to a different friend's house to play video games until 4 a.m. when Stacy dropped Cindy off at her apartment. Stacy was driving. She waved goodbye and drove away, and no one has seen Cindy since then. That's the last time anybody has ever seen her.
They have no idea what happened to her?
No. I mean, I have more than I'm gonna say.
Okay.
Stacy said that she didn't watch her go into the apartment, but she was right outside her apartment. Friends also said that she's not the type of person who would run off with a stranger or someone that she didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But even though Stacy didn't see her go into the apartment, police know that she did because the backpack that she had been carrying the whole night was in her room and had her phone inside it. Another thing, her friends all said she would never go anywhere without her phone.
Do they think that someone was in there waiting for her?
They don't know anything. They have no theories, basically.
That's crazy.
Other than that, the only other evidence they found was her, like, eyelashes on the counter because she had fake eyelashes on. So mm-hmm. she was in her apartment long enough to put her stuff down, take her eyelashes off. And she did have her wallet and her purse on her. Like, that wasn't in the apartment, so, like, and her cards have never been used. Like, they were checking her activity.
But her phone was left?
Her phone was left in her backpack.
Mm-hmm.
Which is weird to me because I feel like most people don't keep their phones in their backpack. I don't know. I guess mm-hmm. I wasn't a college student in 2001, so
yeah.
Hard to say. The next time anything was heard from her or about her was a few months later in Philadelphia's Chinatown district, which is 200 miles away from her apartment. A woman matching her description was seen crying and yelling for help, and later an eyewitness came forward and gave the police a description of the alleged man that possibly abducted her. A police artist created a composite drawing of a man with olive to light brown complexion and medium length hair. He's not a suspect, but the police would like to question him. That's what the website said.
Hmm.
But he isn't a suspect because they have no idea who he is. You know what I mean? Like, that's why they're saying that, so that someone fitting that description would come forward. But at this point, no one's going to fit that description anymore who would have fit it then.
Yeah.
To this day, she's still not been found, and no further evidence at all has been found. They have no theories, no suspects. They know nothing.
That's so frustrating.
I know. It has to be so frustrating for her parents, mm-hmm. like, who I think are still in South Korea, being like, why did we let her go there, you know?
Yeah.
And her aunt and uncle, too, probably feel so guilty that they couldn't have stopped this from happening.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's just crazy that they have no idea.
Literally, like,
no
theories.
Trace at all. So yeah. Weird.
And who's to say that that woman really was her? It could have been any woman.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That
yeah.
just looked somewhat like her. Because it wasn't even like it was someone who knew her and saw her. It was just she fit the description of her.
Yeah.
And descriptions are so vague, you know?
Especially since your looks can change so drastically mm-hmm. in just a few weeks. Like, you
yeah.
can dye your hair from blonde to black, and that can really change.
You get a buzz cut. Like,
yeah, you can shave off. You can get color contacts. You can get
tattoos on your face.
Extend. Yeah, you can change your appearance so fast.
Mm-hmm. I just can't believe they haven't found anything. And police have basically said there's no crime scene, there's no body, there's technically no crime. But it's not that they haven't been looking for her. Mm-hmm. They're just like...
When did this happen?
2001.
2001?
Mm-hmm.
So it's been
22 years.
22
years. And nothing. No one's come forward ever. Nothing has happened. Which
That's
is just so,
so frustrating
crazy
for the
to
family.
Me.
Mm-hmm. All right. So my next case is about a Japanese exchange student named Hoshiro Hattori. I apologize if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. He was shot to death in Louisiana. So Hattori, he was on his way to a Halloween party, and he wound up at the wrong house. This case, by the way, is very quick, very, like, just cut and dry. This is what happened. This was the outcome. So I don't have a crazy amount of details because it's just so simple. Mm-hmm. So Hattori was on his way to a Halloween party, and he got a little lost because he wasn't very familiar with the town that he was in. He wound up at the wrong house, and he thought it was where he was supposed to be. So he went up to the door and knocked on it, and no one answered. So then he started to leave, and then the owner, Rodney Pears, opened the door, and Hattori said, "We're here for the party." And the owner, Rodney, shot Hattori and killed him right on the scene. Rodney did this because he thought that Hattori was trespassing with criminal intent, and Pears was charged with manslaughter, but invoked the castle doctrine, which is when Americans can claim they have the right to apply lethal means to protect their homes. He was found not guilty by a jury. So
this case makes me so mad.
He got nothing. Hattori's parents did get money, but
Thanks for the money, but you killed my son.
Going like, to bring back your son. The thing about this case that makes me most mad is Hattori was leaving.
That's my whole thing. Was he even on the property still? Like, he could have been all the way on the sidewalk. He could have been, like, in the street, basically back at his car.
Mm-hmm. And the owner opened the door, and then Hattori was like, "I'm here for the party," and the owner just shot him.
And, like, he clearly was not doing anything.
I know.
He literally said, "I'm here for the party." Like, yeah. That reminds me of, like, the law that they have in Florida, which is, like, basically the same thing as the castle law, and it just a couple years ago, I can't. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Like, self-defense
is one thing.
always fine. But Hattori wasn't even
there
anywhere
There was nothing
near.
To defend yourself from. He was literally leaving.
Yeah, if Hattori started walking towards
He started trying to open the door.
Ronald, yeah. If that was the case, then you would have a little bit more of an excuse.
I also just get frustrated because I feel like if it wasn't someone super unfamiliar with the area and, like, from a different country, I don't think it would have been handled the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Just because
the case did get a lot of media attention for that reason.
Yeah. Because he wasn't even trespassing. Like, he mm-hmm. knocked on your door and was like, "Oh, I must be at the wrong place. Let's leave."
Yeah.
And left.
Yeah. And Hattori's father said that sometimes he feels like he's still in America and that someday he'll come back home. That's what he says to himself, which just makes me even more sad because he sent his child to a different mm-hmm. country to study and this tragic thing happened.
Yeah.
And really, really unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
Very unnecessary.
And he was just trying to, like, experience, like, American mm-hmm. Halloween, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, just devastating.
Was he with anyone or was he alone?
That I couldn't find.
Because he said, here for the party.
Yeah. That I couldn't find details on, but he did say, "We are here for the
party."
And
I want to know, if he was with someone else, why was he the one who was shot? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know.
Like, just because he spoke to you?
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Not that and whoever else he was with should have gotten shot either.
Yeah.
But like,
yeah.
My next case is the case of Frank Alba. He lived in Omaha, and in 2011, he decided to pull a Halloween prank. Once again, that's in quotes. So he hid in the bushes outside of a friend's house and sat there waiting for trick-or-treaters to come by, planning to scare them with a chainsaw. A real chainsaw with the chain on. Not even like he took that off so he could still rev it or whatever. Anyways, he was wearing an apron with fake blood on it and a hooded sweatshirt. So he was like, you couldn't really see him in the bush at all until he jumped out. He sat there waiting until he heard a group of kids walking by, and this group of kids turned the corner and were about to pass him. And in this group was 12-year-old Leslie Garcia. And when the kids passed him, he jumped out from behind the bush and revved his chainsaw in an attempt to scare the kids. They all ran in different directions screaming, like they were terrified. So his attempt to scare the kids did succeed. They were so terrified, but Leslie Garcia ran into the street because she was trying to get away from this crazy guy with a chainsaw. She ran onto 36th Street, which was apparently very well known to be a busy street. Mm-hmm. So not only did he do this in general, but he did this right next to it, an extremely busy street at night in the dark when there's kids walking around.
Just so irresponsible and just like did not think about your actions.
So Leslie Garcia was hit by a Ford F-250 truck. Mm. She was injured on her neck, head, arms, leg, back, and spine. Oh my God. And a lot of her injuries sustained permanent damage. She was never going to be the same.
How old was she again?
12. Oh, poor girl. So it was probably like one of her first Halloweens going out with just her friends and like not with her parents, and this happened. Her family, mainly her father, sued Frank Alba as well as Hilda Martinez, who was the homeowner, who allowed him to be there outside of her property on this very busy street.
Yeah.
So he sued them for negligence. He sued her for negligence for allowing it to happen on her property. And he also sued Daryl DeVoki, who was the guy who was driving the truck that struck Leslie, which I can see why he did it. You know what I mean? Like, his daughter just got hurt. Like, I get it. But it wasn't his fault, necessarily. I mean, maybe he was speeding. I don't know. If he was speeding, that's one thing. If he was drunk driving or something like that.
Or if he wasn't, if he was looking at his phone. If he was on his phone,
yeah.
Yeah, and not being, like, not paying attention. Mm-hmm.
But if he was just driving and it was just, like, inevitable.
I mean, it's like when you're driving and a deer jumps in front of your car.
Yeah, I know that very well.
Not a whole lot.
There's literally no time to react.
Yeah. So it's very unfortunate. In the dark. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's extremely, extremely sad.
But like, I can't be mad at her family for doing that. You know what I mean? Like,
No, I get it. No, not at all.
Leslie's father also sued the American Family Insurance Co. because they didn't engage in good faith negotiations to settle the claim. That was the insurance company that the house had an insurance policy under. I wasn't able to find anything of if they won these lawsuits, if they got anything out of them, or if they were just dismissed entirely. Mm-hmm. I hope at least a lawsuit for Frank Alba went through, because I think he should have been, like, arrested.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, how is he not arrested for something?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, attempted.
But again, it's child endangerment.
Yeah. I just, these, like, cases like this get me so frustrated. Mm-hmm. Because why? Like, this guy just, like, got sued, but he still walks around. Like, he's still out and about. Mm-hmm. Well, and how is he, like, a grown man thinking that this was a funny idea? Like, it's not even like he was, like, a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was a grown man.
Well, at least she survived, because she could have very easily.
Especially with a truck.
Passed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next case is about Tony Bagley. At the time, he was 7 years old, and this happened on Halloween of 1994. Mm-hmm. So Tony Bagley and his sister, his aunt, and his mother went out trick-or-treating, and this was around 6:15 p.m. He had ran ahead of his sister, aunt, and mother to the street corner to go to the next house. And at the same time, a man wearing a sweatsuit ran into the street and opened fire on the whole Bagley family. A witness told police that the gunman then jumped into a waiting car and left with the headlights off. And so no one really saw. There was a very brief description of who they thought the gunman was. But ultimately, they thought it was gang-related, which can get very complicated in figuring out and convicting someone. So,
and often, like, it's not just involving one person either.
Yeah, it's involving
a
lot of people.
Which makes it 10 times harder.
Yeah. So Tony was shot in the head. His 10-year-old sister, Chanel, was shot and had to have her liver removed, but survived. His mother, Lachelle, was shot in the chest and also survived, and his aunt was shot in the leg, and she survived too.
It's amazing that he shot so many people so quickly, and like it happened so fast. You know what I mean? That's four people.
Yeah. Tony was on life support at first, but then later passed away. The police say that the murders were premeditated, and again, it was a possible gang involvement. Tony Bagley's dad, Anthony Bagley, did not kill his family. That he has no involvement in their deaths, but this is kind of a weird coincidence. 3.5 years after Tony Bagley's death and his family was shot, Tony's dad, Anthony, was convicted of murder on an unrelated case, but he had also shot someone in the middle of the street. And
so
his dad never said if he knew who killed his son. So
I bet it was something like a rival gang related thing.
Yeah.
But his, like, a kid?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just so heartless.
Mm-hmm.
Not that killing anybody is heartful, but.
Yeah.
I can't. Like.
Yeah. Like, you should not kill anyone. But Tony was so innocent.
Yeah, he was, what, 7?
Yes.
And if it's, like, I just don't ever understand when, like, gang-related violence happens, right? And, like, they kill, like, their kid.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a problem with someone, go to them, not their 7-year-old son.
Yeah. It's just really upsetting.
Yeah. So my next case is the case of John Douglas White, who was a pastor at the time of this crime. And he was 55 years old at this time. He was a pastor at the Christ Community Fellowship Church in Michigan. He was engaged to a woman named Sally Gay, whose daughter was Rebecca, who and was 24 years old, and Rebecca had a 3-year-old son. So Rebecca was also his neighbor, and she lived in a trailer. But they lived right next to each other, and White regularly looked after her 3-year-old son. So he regularly babysat him, would drop him off places, you know, whatever she needed, basically. And early on Halloween morning in 2012, White went into Rebecca's home and struck her repeatedly with a rubber mallet and then strangled her to death with a zip tie and undressed her. He had self-reportedly been watching necrophilia videos online, which was the reason he wanted to kill Rebecca. But he didn't follow through on the planned necrophilia because he physically wasn't able to, but other than that, he would have been. He also was drunk at the time. He had several beers beforehand. Not the worst part, but to make matters worse, Rebecca's 3-year-old son was in the trailer during the entire thing.
Again, children are so innocent.
Mm-hmm. No, he had zero idea what was going on. Like, he did not know what happened to his mom because he trusted this guy. Like, he babysat him all the time. He knew him. So after he decided he couldn't follow through with the rest of his plan, he brought her to the woods and left her there. And then he returned to her house to look after her son and even dressed him in his Halloween costume before dropping him off in a parking lot with his father so he could go out trick-or-treating because he felt bad leaving him there, so he didn't want to leave him alone, which I guess that's good, but, like, maybe just don't kill his mom in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean you felt bad? No, you didn't. So he was still currently a pastor during all of this. And he called on his congregation to pray for Rebecca's safe return because they didn't know what happened to her. She was just missing. And her mother, Sally, was a patron of the church. So she had to hear him doing all this, you know, before she knew. Her body wasn't found until 20 hours later, and White confessed to the crime. When he went on trial, Sally, Rebecca's mother, asked the court to show the same lack of mercy to White as he did to her daughter. Mm-hmm. Which, when I first read that, I misread it as her asking for mercy because, like, they were engaged. And I was like, no way. But then I reread it, and I was like, oh, good. Like, because sometimes, a lot of times when, you know, the person who commits the crime is like engaged to or in a relationship with mm-hmm. a family member or a friend of the victim, they'll try to defend them still and be like, no, but he was drunk, but she wasn't like that, which I'm very, very glad she wasn't. Mm-hmm. And this also was not his first arrest. He served 12 years for the manslaughter of a 26-year-old girl, and everyone in the church, including Sally, knew about his past, but he was still able to build a small following. The church was very small. But he was also sentenced to probation for stabbing and choking a 17-year-old girl in 1981.
Okay. How do you become a pastor and... How do you get in that, like, leadership role?
And, like, get people's trust.
Yeah, if you killed someone.
Yeah. So he was sentenced to 56 years to 85 years in prison, and the judge said that with his violent past, there is no reason he should ever be out of prison.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, but it's like,
even after the first killing, you should never be out of prison.
Yeah, which I don't, like, I can't even, how is that only 12? I can't. With, like, whatever. But then, how did he only get probation for stabbing and choking a child? Because mm-hmm. she was 17 years old. That mm-hmm. was a child.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand. I don't get it.
So, yeah. He's in prison.
Good.
And he'll die there.
Stay there. Good.
Yeah.
Okay, so my next one is... My next two, actually, are very short and just to the point.
Well, my next one's like that too.
To the case, I don't know. So my next one is about Carl Jackson. This happened in 1998. He was 21 years old, and Carl and his girlfriend were on their way to pick up her, I believe he was nine, her 9-year-old son from a party on Halloween. And I'm not sure if it was when they got to where the party was or if they were at a stop sign. Mm-hmm.
I want to say it was a stop sign from what I read, but it was a few weeks ago that I read it.
I didn't see it, so... anyway,
yeah.
The car was stopped, and teenagers started throwing eggs at their car. And Carl got out and started yelling at the teens to stop, and then he was going to get back in the car, and one of the teenagers, 17-year-old Curtis Sterling, pulled out a gun and shot Jackson in the head. And Jackson died instantly. Sterling was charged with second-degree murder and criminal possession of a weapon. He was sentenced to 20 years, and according to New York Times, Sterling receives, I'm not sure if he's still in prison. I think he would be out now if he did get out. Mm-hmm. He would receive a letter every Halloween from Carl Jackson's mom, and it would simply say, "I'm glad you're still there."
Good for her.
Mm-hmm.
That had to be so, like, therapeutic for her to do.
Mm-hmm. To know that he was still in prison.
But then when he got out.
I'm hoping that he's still in there. I should have looked that up.
That is just so for wild to
no
me.
No reason.
Literally. Like, it's not even like he was trying to start a fight with them. He was just like, what, like, can
he,
you not? What's wrong with you?
He just got out of his car and said, stop.
And then was literally getting back into his car.
Yeah.
Someone had anger issues for sure.
Yeah.
What was his name? Who killed him?
Curtis Sterling.
Yeah. He needed to be in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at 17 and yeah. you just happen, like, you're just out and about and you have a gun
mm-hmm.
and eggs. Like, that's what's actually so amazing to me. The fact that they go from, like, such a, like, cliche thing of, like, throwing eggs at people's cars or their houses to then shooting a man mm-hmm. within, like, a minute.
Yeah.
Like, that's so, like, it doesn't connect.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my next case is also super short, and it also doesn't connect. There's very no justifiable reason for what happened, but you'll see. This is the case of Liddell Peoples, who was 55 years old and lived in Chicago. This happened in 2011. He was with his partner, Maria Adams, who was 49, on Halloween. Some places said that they were partners. Other places said described him as an acquaintance of hers. I'm just going with partner for now because it's the first one that I saw, and I can't be sure which it is, so it's just easier to put it that way. He basically, Peoples, accused Adams of stealing his Tootsie Rolls, Jolly Ranchers, and Hershey's that were in some bag of candy. And then they proceeded to argue about it, and at some point in the argument, Adams allegedly threw a plate at Peoples, and he had a gash above his eye. So his response to that was grabbing a knife and repeatedly stabbing Adams, who later died at Stroger Hospital. She just succumbed to all the stab wounds. And Peoples was charged with attempted murder and aggravated domestic battery and was sentenced to 30 years in prison.
30 years.
When I first found this case, I was about to go look into it, I was like, was he drunk? Was there other problems going on? Did something else happen? Yeah. No.
Was their relationship declining?
Nope. He just was like, my candy's gone, so you took it. And she was like, no, I didn't. So he stabbed her. Like,
over something so stupid.
So childish.
Candy. Yeah.
Like, a 10-year-old wouldn't even want, like, a 10-year-old wouldn't even, like, throw a tantrum at that point. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like I said, it's really, it's just straight to the point. Like, I was so confused when I was looking it up. I was like, there's nothing else? Nothing?
No alcohol, no drugs.
It didn't say
no
anything.
No anger issues, no
I mean, clearly he did.
Issues.
Yeah.
That's just so.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my next one is super, super short. So this is about the murders of Ronald Seisman, who was 39, and Elizabeth Platzman, who was 20. So Ronald Seisman was a photographer in Manhattan, and Elizabeth Platzman was a student at Smith College.
Mm-hmm.
They were both found beaten and shot in the photographer Ronald's apartment. And the apartment had been ransacked, but nothing was taken, and there was no sign of forced entry. And that's all we know. There's no suspects. They think that it was probably someone that Ronald knew, mm-hmm. since there was no sign of forced entry. And since nothing was taken, they don't think it was a robbery gone wrong. They think that someone had something against Ronald or Elizabeth, or like had something against their relationship, whatever their relationship was, and killed them, but they never figured out who it was.
It's just like Cindy's song, mm-hmm. just nothing.
Yeah.
My next case is actually similar in the sense of no evidence. This is the case, the murder of Marvin Brandland. So on Halloween in 1982, Marvin Brandland and his wife Ethel were handing out candy to trick-or-treaters. When somebody else knocked on their door, the couple went to answer it. I believe it was Ethel who was at the door, but Marvin was nearby. So they were met with a masked man, and the mask he had was a pillowcase, like it wasn't an actual mask. And he said, "Trick-or-treat, give me your money or I'll shoot." So the couple thought it was just some stupid Halloween prank, and they tried to take his mask off, but he held it down. And then Ethel was like, okay, this is weird, I'll just give him his candy and he'll leave. So she turned around and grabbed some candy, and he followed her inside and took out a gun. He then told them to give him the money from their safe in the basement, which very few people knew about. Not even all their family members, select family members knew that they had this safe in their basement. Meaning somebody related to them did it. So he was trying to get them to go to the basement. Marvin refused to go further than the kitchen. and he had a gun in the kitchen, so he tried to grab the gun, but the masked man shot Marvin in the throat and took off his mask, threw it down, and ran out of the house. Marvin was rushed to a hospital, but he succumbed to the gunshot wound. I mean, it was right in his neck.
Yeah, that's...
like, you cannot get there fast enough for that.
Yeah.
So Ethel suffered really greatly from her loss. At Thanksgiving that year, she had this crazy, like, not crazy, but this breakdown. She was just eating, and then all of a sudden, she just stopped and, like, had, like, you know, hysterically crying, and her whole family tried to comfort her. She died a few months later.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's so sad.
She just, like, missed him so much.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to be awful. Not just the fact that he died, but the fact that you saw it happen and you couldn't do anything, and that it could have been you, too, because you were also there.
Mm-hmm.
So, apparently, an acquaintance of the family bragged to the two family members that he was the shooter, but police didn't have any evidence to arrest him. So he's their prime suspect, but he hasn't been arrested because they have no evidence. Like, they won't be able to convict him even if they arrest him. What? The only piece of the literal only piece of evidence they have was the pillow sheet that he used for his mask. But when they sent it out for testing, there wasn't enough material to pull out any DNA.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Which I can't remember the lead investigator's name, but he was so, like, surprised by that. So they know they. Basically, they're pretty sure it's this guy, but they just can't do anything about it. And even if it isn't this man that they think it is, it's a family member or another, like a family friend.
Which is
because no one else knew about their safe. And I don't even know if there was, like, that much money in the safe. Like, it's not like they had $1 million in there or $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once again, obviously, that's not justifying it. It's just like, really?
Mm-hmm. All right. So my last case is about William Lisk.
Mm.
So in 2010, which is probably the most recent case that we're talking about.
I had 2011.
Oh, okay. Well, I think it's one of the more
recent cases. Yeah, I had two 2011s.
Okay. Well, one of the more recent cases that I'm talking about. So 16-year-old Devin Griffin had come home on Halloween after being out all day and spending the previous night sleeping at a friend's house. He started playing video games and then kind of just realized that the house was really quiet. He had a brother and his parents, his stepfather and his mom, and he didn't hear any of them, so he went to look for them, and he found his mother and his stepfather dead in their bedroom, just completely covered in blood. When police arrived, they then found William's brother, Derek, who had been beaten with a hammer and shot.
That's so overkill.
Yeah. His stepfather, William Lisk, was shot 5 times, and Devin's mother, Susan Lisk, was sexually assaulted and shot. So investigators pretty quickly found out that it was Devin's stepbrother, William Lisk, who was named after his father. Not to confuse that, the stepfather's name is William Lisk. He also goes as Bill, and his son, he named William Lisk too. He's the one that killed his father, his stepmom, who is Devin's mom, and
Devin's brother,
who would have been William's stepbrother. He pled guilty to 3 counts of aggravated murder to avoid the death penalty. But then he was found dead in his jail cell in 2015 from a self-inflicted wound. The reason why he did this is kind of unknown. He never gave, like, a full excuse as to why, he felt like he needed to kill them. But
what's shocking to me is the fact that he did it when Devin wasn't home. You know what I mean? That he didn't kill the whole family.
Well, the reason why they think he killed them is because he had problems with his stepmom.
Oh.
Yeah. That's what I read. He had, like, arguments that turned violent with the stepmom, mm-hmm. and like especially after his dad and his stepmom got married, he just had a lot of anger towards her. So I think his main reason was to mm-hmm. kill her, and then maybe was mad at his father too for marrying her, and then
stepbrother was there.
Yeah. Or maybe it just, maybe they were having an argument that night and it escalated and he killed them just in the spur of the moment.
Mm, yeah. I mean, like you said, they had violent arguments in the past and he had schizophrenia. He had a lot of mental health problems.
Yeah.
Maybe he should have been in like a treatment program, but maybe he was. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Just very unfortunate that Devin found his family. I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
Especially at 16 years old.
And then
old.
Being the only one left, except mm-hmm. your stepbrother, who's the one who did it.
Yeah. Well, no, because he...
Well, now, yeah. I meant like in the moment. I meant in the moment.
Oh, well.
I meant in 2011 when it, or 2010 when it happened.
Yeah. Okay. So the last case that we're going to talk about is on the Toolbox Killers. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go into a little background on who the Toolbox Killers were, and then Becky's going to talk about the case that happened on Halloween.
Yeah. And this is one that we were talking about in the beginning that we're definitely going to do another episode on, where we focus just on this case because they were serial killers.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of information.
Yeah. So the Toolbox Killers were Lawrence Sigmund Bittaker and Roy Lewis Norris. Mm-hmm. They were two American serial killers and rapists. They committed kidnapping, rape, torture, and murder of 15 girls in Southern California over a five-month period in 1979. Again, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on all of that because we do want to do it in a future episode, and Becky's going to talk about
the one case specific
that, we're talking about today. But Bittaker was sentenced to death for all five murders, mm-hmm. and he was sentenced in 1981. He died of natural causes, though, while he was on death row in 2019. Norris took a plea bargain and testified against Bittaker, and he was sentenced to life in 1980, with the possibility of parole after 30 years.
Bruh, why? I get that it's a plea deal, but...
Mm-hmm. He died of natural causes in a medical facility in 2020. So I think he did get out and then, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to get into the last murder that they committed, which was on October 31st, 1979. A 16-year-old girl named Shirley Ledford was hitchhiking home from a Halloween party in Burbank, California. Lawrence Bittaker and Roy Norris picked her up in their van, which was the same way that they got most of their victims, but, you know, we're not going to deal about that. So they took her to a secluded location like they did with all their previous victims and tortured her using tools out of their toolbox, thus the name Toolbox Killers. They sexually assaulted and sodomized her, used a sledgehammer to bludgeon her elbow, used pliers to torture her before they strangled her to death with a coat hanger. And this wasn't a fast thing. It was very drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. The entire thing was recorded by Norris and Bittaker. And later they bragged about the torture and murders that they had committed over the past 5 months to a friend of theirs who thankfully reported them to the police and they were arrested. So Bittaker was tried, and the prosecutor, Stephen Kay, was going to play the recording of the torture. They played 10 minutes of it for the jury to hear. And before to the jury, he said, "For those of you who do not know what hell is like, you will find out." And then played it. And a lot of the jurors, you know, cried. I mean, I can't imagine not crying hearing it. He was sentenced to death, like Ella said, and Norris was sentenced to life with possibility of parole because he agreed to testify against Bittaker.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very, very vague description of what happened, but we do want to do a future episode where we just focus on this one and not even do our normal two crimes per episode.
So let us know if you'd like us to do that. Mm-hmm. I think that wraps us up.
Yeah, pretty much. Just again, stay safe tonight on Halloween. I know we're all out having fun. Just be mindful that you're staying safe while you're having your fun.
Yeah. And stay with your group. Mm-hmm. Don't go off by yourself.
Yeah. Let us know if you liked the format of this episode, if we should do stuff like this more often, mm-hmm. or if you hated it. Let us know.
I enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too.
I think it's a good way for us to get more ideas for different cases, mm-hmm. too. And yeah, for true. You guys to let us know if you liked any of them yeah. and are interested in us going deeper into them.
Yeah. So follow us on Instagram.
@behind_the_crime.
And at Facebook at just Behind the Crime.
Yeah.
And we have been working on some new things. We have a website published. It's a work in progress, but if you do want to check it out, it is linked in our bio on Instagram and not Facebook yet, but I'll do that today.
Yeah. And we may be working on a YouTube page.
Channel.
Oh, a YouTube channel. How can you can tell that I'm not on YouTube, but. We might have a little channel coming out.
Yeah. So, thanks for listening.
Yeah. And we'll see you guys in
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Or actually, it might just be next week. It's just next week.
Yeah,
because
next
this
week.
Is a special bonus episode.
So see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.